Good morning. So, as you know, my name's Phil, and I'm the lead chaplain from Queen's and King George Hospital. But I'm going to talk to you this morning really about finding moments of beauty within the trauma, which affects all of us. I'm going to talk a bit about the hospital and give you some facts and figures and stuff. And then I'm going to talk about what it was like to be a chaplain during COVID as well. So that's the plan. But we might get distracted and we might go on tangents, and that's fine as well. Bit about me, as you know, I was a youth worker beforehand. I trained with the YMCA and I worked in the YMCA for many years. As I said to you before, I think that was going to be my career. God, I'd have a plans. A lot of people think chaplains are employed by the church. We're not. I have nothing to do with the Church of England other than the fact they licensed me, they ordained me to wear a bit of plastic around my neck. I'm paid by the NHS, the same as nurses and doctors, not as much as doctors, but paid by the NHS. So a lot of people think we only work with our own particular faith group. That's not true at all, but more about that later. And as Ian mentioned earlier, I'm also chaplain to God's football team, which is West Ham United. I started there as the academy chaplain when the season we moved to the new stadium. Adam, what was that, 2016?
Yeah.
And I then became the main club chaplain about 18 months ago, just over a year ago. And it's very similar to hospital work. It's about pastoral care, and I'll share a little bit more about that later. And they need a lot of pastoral care, I can tell you. So, moments of beauty within the trauma. BHR, UT, Barkinghaven and Redbridge University Hospitals Trust has roughly 8,500 staff. It's the largest employer in the three boroughs. It's a city within itself. 8,500 staff with approximately 1,100 patients between the two sites. And now we've also got the Barking Hospital as well, which is it's not an overnight stay place, it's like a day place. The A&E, if you've been unfortunate enough to go there recently, you will know it's extremely busy. It was built to house around 300 patients a day. We get 1,000. So it's already doubled the size of what it should be built for. There just isn't enough space, there isn't enough staff to cope with the demand, which is why you'll end up seeing patients on trolleys in corridors. And if, you know, depending on what's wrong with you, you could be there for 3 or 4 days just in A&E before you get moved to a ward. So it's a very, very, very high-pressured place. One of the differences, one of the things that we talk about often in chaplaincy is the difference between spiritual and pastoral care and religious care. I get asked a lot, well, what's the difference between pastoral care and religious care? What is it? It's very easy to describe, okay? Spiritual and pastoral care is finding out what's important to people and then through those things make some sense and meaning of that person's journey. So for example, I might be working with, I'm going to generalise now, an 85-year-old man who's been told he's got roughly 3 months to live. Everyone's focusing on those 3 months. Where's that man going to go? Is he going to stay in hospital? Is he going to go to the hospice? Is he going to go home? What medications are you going to be on, etc., etc. Everyone's focusing on the 3 months that person's got to live. The thing that's upsetting that man more than anything else, he's just going to look after his dog when he dies, because that's his lifeline. And our job as chaplains is to get alongside people and through those, find out what's important to them and through those things make some sense of meaning and work with them on that journey. Or the relative, or the staff member. And I'll talk more about staff later, but we work with a lot of staff. Religious care is exactly what it says on the tin. Every religion has a set of rituals that go with it. So for Christians, it could be praying, reading the Bible, receiving communion, an end-of-life prayer if it's at that stage. For a Muslim, it's fasting, praying. Every religion's got a set of rituals. And our job as chaplains is to administer them where possible or bring somebody in to do that. Everybody thinks that's all we do. It's actually the smallest part of what we do. That's about 20% of my job. The other 80 is the spiritual and pastoral care, which is finding out what is important to people and then through those things making the journey with them. And interestingly, in the small part of the 20% of religious care, it is end-of-life care. that we tend to do the most of. So that's the difference between spiritual and pastoral care. Our team of chaplains, just to give you some facts and figures, we've got three full-time Christian chaplains, which I'm the lead of. We've got two part-time Christian, we've got two part-time Muslim, one part-time Jewish, and then we've got a whole bank of volunteers from Sikh, Hindu, and every other faith going, who work with us and support our work. So we're quite a large team. I manage three services. I manage chaplaincy, I manage bereavement, I also manage a new service called Medical Examiner Officers. So as of September this year, it should have been April last year, and then it should have been April this year, the government have now moved it to September, that every death in the country, whether you die at home, in a hospital, in a car accident, whatever, it doesn't matter where, every death, before you can register the death, has to be scrutinised by a medical examiner. Okay? My job now is also managing the medical examiner officers who do all the paperwork, ring the families and all that sort of stuff. So it's quite a... It's quite a busy job. Some moments of beauty within the trauma, which I see on a daily basis. The NHS education for Scotland says spiritual care is this: that care which recognises and responds to the needs of the human spirit when faced with trauma, ill health, or sadness, and can include the need for meaning, for self-worth, to express oneself, for faith support, perhaps for rites or prayers or sacrament, or simply for a sensitive listener. Spiritual care begins with encouraging human contact in compassionate relationship and moves in whatever direction need requires. That, to me, sums up what spiritual and pastoral care and what chaplaincy really, in essence, is all about. So some examples of moments of beauty within the trauma. There's hundreds, but you know, you'll have your own versions of this. You'll have your own experiences. But I always say to people that within the trauma and tragedy of life, there are moments of beauty. An example that I give: there was a young 7-year-old who got killed in Harold Wood, famously. I think it's about 6 years ago now. Harvey Till. He got electrocuted in the pub by Harold Wood Station. It made the news. The owner of the pub went to prison. I was on duty that night, and I was literally walking out of the hospital at 6 o'clock in the evening when my pager went off. Phil, can you come to resus? He's a 7-year-old. So I goes there, and I meet the family. I meet Lewis and Danielle. What do you say? There is no textbook. There's nothing at Bible college or vicar school that teaches you what to say in those circumstances. You have to think on your feet. So I sat with them for a while, mainly in silence, to be honest with you. But I kept going back into the room and checking, because they weren't allowed to see Harvey at this point. I kept going into resus to check, okay, what's going on? When can the family come in, etc., etc. So I held their emotion for about an hour. Just held their emotion and sat with them while they were hysterical, as you would be. And the moment of beauty, there were several actually, but one of them was, as we walked in, I held both their hands as we walked into behind the curtain. Obviously they were hysterical, they broke down. I said some prayers. The mum, Danielle, who I'm very close friends with now, and the family, I'm good friends with them. They said to me, my dad's going to come in a minute, and he ain't going to want to see you. He's really anti-religion. I went, okay. I said, I can leave. And she grabbed me, and she said, don't you dare leave. I need you here. I went, okay, how am I going to manage this one? This is going to be difficult. So then walks this big guy. Her dad was massive. Right? He walks in, and as he's walking towards me, he's crying, he's angry, he wants to blame God. He doesn't really know what's going on. All he knows is his grandson is dead. I take off the bit of plastic around my neck, like that. And as he walks towards me, I shove it in his hand, and I put my arm around him. That was a moment of beauty within the trauma. because he grabbed it and he held on to it really tight. I thought he was going to cut his hand at one point. He held on it so tight. And then he held me just as tight. And I couldn't move. And I was really starting to think, okay, mate, you need to release me a little bit. I can't breathe. And I stood with him while he cried his eyes out. And I just kept saying to him, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. That was a moment of beauty. And then, in fact, we then got on quite well after that, and the relationship really developed. And I ended up doing the service for their school, the junior school in Havelwood, or Havelwood Hill. And then I did the funeral, which was probably one of the biggest funerals I've ever done. But there was moments of beauty within that. And I was at a funeral recently. The reason I'm mentioning this now, I was doing a funeral recently about 6 weeks ago, and Danielle was there, the mum was there. And as I'm shaking hands to people on the way out, she came up to me, threw her arms around me, and she said, moments of beauty within the trauma. I've never forgotten what you said. So that was a real testament, really, in value of my belief of there are moments of beauty within the trauma. And there's also, and they can be quite funny. Moments of beauty can be funny moments. As I said to him, when my dad was dying and he was on his deathbed, I mean, he was pretty unconscious for most of the week, but there was one moment when he woke up and the nurse said to him, oh, okay, Ken, we were chatting. And at that point, we weren't sure whether he was going to stay there or wanted to go to the hospice. It turned out he was too ill to go to the hospice in the end. But he said, oh, no, I want to go to the hospice because I'm a member there. What? I'm a member there. I said, Dad, you can't be a member of the hospice. What he meant was he did this lottery ticket once a week for the hospice. £1 a week he got a lottery ticket for. And he thought that was a membership thing. So he was paying monthly, every week £1, thinking he was a member of the... Dad, it don't work that way. And the funniest thing was, when it was sad in some senses, again, another moment of beauty. The Sunday morning, it was a Sunday morning when we got the phone call, can you come in? The dad's deteriorated overnight and he could go any time. We didn't know it was going to last another week at that point. So I've rushed in. And my dad said to me, son, can you give me the last rites? And that's an experience, giving your own father, last rites. So I did that. And then he said to me, right, what time is your sister coming in? And my sister was in Manchester at the time. I said, well, she knows, she's on her way down. She'll be in about 3 hours. Okay, well, I'll go then. Where are you going to go, Dad? Well, I'll die then. I'll die when she gets here. Dad, you can't just dictate when you're going to go. He said that 2 or 3 times. Oh, that's a night. I can go now. It took a week, but he was funny. He was a very funny man, my dad. Again, but moments of beauty within that trauma and within that tragedy. So spiritual care and religious care is what we do on a daily basis. During COVID, during COVID, I wrote an article for what I thought was going to be just for staff. I wrote it as a newsletter type thing to support staff, really. And then the comms department at the hospital got wind of it. And then they sent it to the paper and it got published. And I want to read just a bit of it to you because it gives you a really good flavour of what it was like to be a minister at the hospital at that particular time. And you'll all relate to this because COVID affected every single person in this church. It's not something that you could avoid or escape. It affected everybody. So forgive me for reading. It's just easier if I read this to you. Often when taking a sermon or even a training session, I use the phrase finding moments of beauty in the tragedy on trauma. And no truer phrase comes to mind when I look back on this time. I think I've experienced every type of emotion possible in recent months. I've been challenged in every part of my life, at times feeling like I was in control and playing the superhero, and other times I felt like a complete failure and wanted to curl up in a ball and hide. I've cried with those around me, and I've also laughed and had feelings of joy and pride. As I say, a real roller coaster of feelings, emotions, and moments of beauty. I was on annual leave when lockdown started, so when I arrived at work the following week, along with the rest of the world, the hospital had changed so much. I remember feeling anxious, wondering what I was walking into, but I also had a real desire to get back to work and be part of the madness that was starting to surround us. Now, bear in mind, we didn't know how long COVID was going to last at this point. We thought COVID was going to be about a six-week thing. On Saturday evening, I was on call, and I'd already been contacted to give end-of-life care to two COVID-19 patients, when I was called again to go to King George Hospital to support another COVID patient and a daughter. As I drove along the A127, I remember feeling afraid. PPE, which is the protective gear that we had to wear, was still new to everyone, and I wondered if I'd put it on correctly and whether it would work. It was the Easter weekend, and the pandemic was at its peak, and our staff were already exhausted, and everyone was feeling the pressure. I arrived at the ward, which was very surreal, as it looked like a scene from a science fiction film. I was advised what PPE to put on, and did so with a little bit of trepidation. As I put on the gown, I remember thinking, how close can I sit to the patient and her daughter? It wasn't the first time that I'd put on the gown and the mask, but it felt different this time. It felt more intense. I arrived at the bedside and sat with the daughter, who was crying and holding her mum's hand. Her mum had just died. I felt sick that I hadn't got there in time. Questions rushed through my mind. Did I take too long putting on the PPE? Could I have driven faster? And we sat together and talked, and I prayed over her mum. Through her tears, she told me that her father had died just 4 days previously of COVID in the room next door. This disease had ripped her family apart like a wave crashing against the boat and ripping it in two. I sat with her in silence for some time, helping her to regain some strength. And when I got back to my car, I did something that I hadn't done as a chaplain before. I sat there and I cried. Exhausted, crying, but proud to have been part of this family's journey. I felt like I had played my part and contributed to the cause. Our work changed pretty much overnight as a chaplaincy team. Each morning, our mortuary would send us a list of patients who had died and which mortuary hub they had been taken to. Now, if you remember, there was pop-up mortuaries all around different boroughs. Then we had and there's like inflatable morgues. And our job was to ring the family to tell them that their loved one had been moved from our hospital to another place. We would then call the next of kin to inform them that they would give them information to their undertaker about which hub they were going to be at. We were then asked again to ring the family a few days later to see how they were progressing in arranging the funeral. This was because the pop-up hubs were already under pressure and the bodies needed to be moved to the funeral directors. I found this hard at first. What do you say to somebody who has just lost a loved one that they weren't able to visit in hospital? And I was calling them to tell them they'd been moved to a temporary mortuary hub, maybe nowhere near them. We were sending people from Queens all the way over to West London, over to Middlesex, really, and to Wembley. But after finding the right words, this became an important part of my work. Families would often be very grateful for the call, and it gave them a chance to talk about their loved one, as well as crying and letting off emotions. It was time-consuming, given that I was calling so many families each day. However, it was also a privilege, and I felt it was worthwhile and something that we could do well during the chaos that was surrounding us. I found it harder as demand became greater. However, especially when contacting families again regarding funeral arrangements, I felt like I was intruding on them, calling them again, saying, have you arranged this? Have you arranged that? But I had to do it with compassion and empathy. But I also had a job to do because our mortuaries were becoming full and full and full. And all the families that I spoke to weren't coping. It had a personal effect on me as well. When I was sitting at a patient's bedside, I felt like I was playing my part and had a purpose. Making telephone calls began to feel a bit like chasing numbers, and I started to feel helpless. However, I then started to see the calls as a real supportive way of supporting families. And in fact, we still do that now. That's a piece of work that we've carried on post-COVID. In April and May of that particular year, I spoke to over 380 families to tell them that their loved ones had died and had moved to a temporary pop-up mortuary. Like so many staff, the pandemic affected me outside work too. But as time went on, I started to struggle. I felt the management side of the work became overwhelming, and I didn't consider how COVID was affecting me and having a knock-on effect. When you deal with a trauma, you tend to go into the situation, deal with the trauma, and then you come away from it, and you go back to some form of reality. With COVID, you couldn't do that because you went into the trauma and the trauma came with you back home as well. We were all living in that trauma. I was going through some significant personal issues at the time. I was going through a marriage breakup. I'd just moved out of the family home. I was going through a very amicable divorce. And I found living on my own quite difficult at that time because I couldn't go out and I'm a sociable person. And I found that I was getting cabin fever, just being locked in all the time. I mentioned staff support. Before COVID, we probably supported around about 760 staff a year. So in 2019, in our annual report, we supported 760 staff. In 2020, the year of COVID, that went up to 2,000. Last year, it was 3,000. And I was chatting to somebody beforehand, and I said that for the first time in the last 3 months, and the first time in my career as a chaplain, I'm seeing just as many staff as I'm seeing patients, or my team are. We're seeing just as many staff. We reckon next year that will also double, so about 6,000 staff, 6,000 patients. So that's a massive, massive piece of work. One of the things that helped me, and this is a real moment of beauty within all the trauma, was this book, The Boy and the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. How many people have seen this before? It's been on the bestseller list for the last 5 or 6 years. It's been an amazing book. I used to use it a lot with staff, especially with nurses. Let me just read this to you. This book is for everyone, whether you are 8 or 80. I feel like I'm both sometimes. I'd like it to be one where you can dip into anywhere, anytime, start in the middle if you like, scribble on it, crease the corners, and leave it well thumbed. The drawings are mainly of a boy, a mole, a fox, and a horse. I'll tell you a little bit about them, although I'm sure you'll see things here that I don't, so I'll be quick. The boy is lonely when the mole first surfaces. They spend time together gazing into the wild. I think the wild's a bit like life, frightening sometimes, but beautiful. In their wanderings, they meet the fox. It's never going to be easy meeting a fox if you're a mole. The boy is full of questions. The mole is greedy for cake. The fox is mainly silent and wary because he's been hurt by life. The horse is the biggest thing they have ever encountered, and also the gentlest. They are all different, like us, and each has their own weaknesses. I can see myself in all four of them. Perhaps you can too. Their adventures happen in springtime, when one moment snow is falling and the sun shines the next, which is also a little bit like life. It can turn on a sixpence. I hope this book encourages you perhaps to live courageously with more kindness for yourself and for others, and to ask for help when you need it, which is always a brave thing to do. When I was making the book, I often wondered, who on earth am I to be doing this? But as the horse says, the truth is, everyone is winging it. I found those words really, really, really encouraging during that COVID process. And I used it a lot with staff and staff training sessions and Zooms and Teams meetings. We didn't have Zoom and Teams meetings before COVID. We never. We used to use that book a lot. So finding moments of beauty within the trauma and how that affects all of us. And I often think it's when God shows himself to you is often that moment of beauty. Sometimes it could be a smile, it could be something as simple as somebody squeezing your hand. It could be, one of the moments when my dad was ill was when the doctor knelt down below, to the same level as my dad in the bed. The doctor knelt down to speak to him and had eye contact and held his hand. That to me was a moment of beauty. Doctor holding my dad's hand as he spoke to him about his diagnosis. And I often say to people, when challenges are thrown to us in life, and we've all got them on a daily basis, the thing that can help you get through those is the moment of beauty within that trauma. Because they're from God. They're God moments. Little snippets of God in the here and the now. I'm conscious of time, and I'm happy to take some questions. But no, that's unheard of. The minister asks questions and shout them out again, but I'm happy to do that because we've got about another 5 minutes or so. But I just want to end with this particular quote, because it's very simple. And if you haven't seen this book, I really recommend you buy it, because it's just full of beautiful drawings and pictures and just simple phrases. There's a picture of a boy on the horse looking into the distance. And the boy says, "We have such a long way to go," sighed the boy. "Yes, but look how far we've come," said the horse. Amen to that. Yeah, okay. Any? I've stunned you into silence and depressed you all this morning, didn't I? Sorry, that weren't meant to be the outcome. Any questions anyone wants to ask about West Ham, God's football team? More than happy to answer that. Sorry? Yeah? I think it's because, so the question was, why has the government changed it that every death has to be scrutinised? I think there's a variety of reasons. One of them, I know for a fact, is because they want to make sure we don't have another Harold Shipman situation where a doctor can murder people, or so there's no sort of indiscrepancies and that sort of stuff. So one, it's to learn from. It's two, it's to monitor so that there's a fairness and an equilibrium for the whole country. But I don't know. I mean, I know there's some nurses here. I recognise some faces. I don't know the ins and outs of that, of why that is. We were just told you have to have it. And our hospital was the last one to get a team of people to do that.
How do you maintain your own mental stability when you are giving so much that is so draining?
I drink in the tap room in Upminster. I like real ale. And that's serious. I've got a good set of friends there, so I often go and have a pint. I'm very fortunate. People always say to me, "You must find your job really depressing." I don't. I find it an absolute wonderful job. When I was running the YMCA tower block at Roney Oak Corner, I was stressed because I never knew what I was walking into, and I weren't good at it either. I was rubbish at it. I was a rubbish housing manager. Hence why I lost the job in the end, really. That was stressful. I don't find this job stressful. When I was out of work for 6 months, I took 6 months off after being made redundant, when I started to train to be a chaplaincy volunteer, which then led into going off to college and doing an MA in pastoral theology and getting ordained and stuff. I turned around and I said to my wife at the time, I said, "I just want someone to pay me to be me. Talking to people, chatting and getting alongside people, networking." And that, to me, is what chaplaincy is. I'm being paid to do what I love. So I don't carry the same burden, as it were. And I hand it to God on a daily basis as well. You know, when I'm leaving the hospital, I'm leaving it at the hospital. I'm able to do that. I have a good set of friends. My daughter is autistic with ADHD, so that takes up a lot of my time. I co-parent, and so I see her all the time. So that takes my mind away from work quite a bit. So I focus on her. Yeah.
So God's friends and real ale.
God's friends and real ale. Absolutely. Yeah.
And music, Phil.
And music, yeah, that's it.
Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm into my music. I know Adam from West Ham, so yeah, and we've got a love of music. And yeah.
Yeah. One of the doctors, and you mentioned this football team called West. themselves.
Yeah, they were.
What did they
It's interesting, really, because a lot of football teams have them now with their own badge on. So we, kindly, with your help and support, we managed to get, I think it was something like 200 or 300 New Gideon Bibles, New Testament Bibles, not called Gideon's no more, are they? New Testament Bibles with the West Ham badge on the front. And they went down like hotcakes. I mean, they really went down well. And it's really interesting. You take sport, for example, and you take a Premiership football team, and you think, well, where's God in all that? These people are earning more money than I'll earn in my lifetime, in a month. You know, God's everywhere. You know, I was over the training ground at the first team in Rush Green on Friday morning, and I had a real heart-to-heart with David Moore as the manager about how he's feeling in the world and how he's coping with life. You know, just because you've got money don't make you immune to illnesses, diseases, feelings and emotions. It might help you in some ways and make you feel better in other ways, but actually it brings its own problems. And Adam will know that from working with the young people and the youngsters. You know, they've got these big dreams. I'm going to make it as a football player, and I'm going to earn this, I'm going to earn that. And they do, compared to what in the olden days, when I was growing up watching football as a kid, they do earn silly money. But they've all got their own issues and their own problems. And they all come and say that the role of the chaplain at West Ham has really been, well, it's almost all pastoral. It's just about being there. We call it loitering with intent. So I go to the training ground and I loiter with intent. I will sit around the coffee machine or the canteen area and just be. And sometimes they might just shake your hand. The players will come in, give you a hug, shake your hand, say hello. Other times they will say, oh, I'm glad you're here. Can I have a little chat to you about something? You know, and that's all the staff as well, coaching staff, ground staff. I mean, one of the things, that, just quickly on that, actually, and again, moments of beauty, the kit man for the academy caught COVID and was seriously ill, wasn't he? He was on death's door at one point in Queens, and I became the link between him, his family, and West Ham Football Club. So West Ham were ringing me every day, how is he today, how is he today? Family couldn't go in, so I was doing video phone messages with his wife and his daughters, and I became the link. That, interestingly, really secured my role as a chaplain within the club, because then they saw how important having someone like a chaplain involved is really important in sport. And this chap, I belong to an agency called Sports Chaplaincy UK, and all sports have chaplains now. Cricket, golf, football, rugby, swimming, athletics, horse racing. Casinos have even got chaplains now. Yeah. Anyway, I'm digressing. Sorry.
Just want to give you a huge thanks for sharing with us. And as we're clapping, can we do so again to affirm the amazing chaplaincy team who are there day by day in the hospital caring for those in need? Thank you so much. Thank you. Bless you. And I do recommend that book. It's written by a Christian. He's talking about his faith through those parables within that book. So if you have a chance just to read it, it's not got biblical context, it's not got scripture in that, but it has got biblical narrative going through. And I do recommend it to you. Beauty in trauma. We started off the service today pondering you what the Almighty can do. And maybe today, as we've heard the stories, as we've heard that narrative, we need to ponder, what, Lord, are you wanting to do in me? Maybe you're crying out to see some beauty in trauma. Maybe today you just need to see God at work, and you've come angry with God. Look, Phil will let you rip his dog collar off if that's going to help you. Maybe you've come just to know and want to meet with God. We're going to sing a very simple song, Spirit of the Living God, fall afresh on me. I think that's the one we're singing, isn't it? Yeah, it's fine, because I've lost my order of service, but that's fine. We're going to stay seated. But maybe you need to do something, and you want to see some beauty. I'm going to invite you as we're singing, as a prayer, to just come towards the front. There'll be those who can come and pray with you, or just be quiet with you. But maybe today, you're needing to see some beauty in your trauma. You don't need to explain the trauma, you don't need to tell anybody about anything. But God is here. God is here. There's a children's song that says, God is here, Almighty God is here. Almighty God is here. As we sing, know the presence of the living God. And if you want somebody to pray with you or just to come and be quiet as a cry to God, as people are singing, just walk down to the front. There's an empty row here. It doesn't matter if the empty row gets filled. We're going to start filling other front row spaces and that. Come forward and meet with God and find beauty in your trauma.